Bismillah, assalamu alaikum everyone. We are incredibly delighted and privileged and honored to welcome Imam Khalid, his beautiful daughter Medina, and his students from New York University to join us tonight in this to address all of you. Imam Khalid has an extraordinary biography. I could not do it justice by reading the entire thing. I'm going to read, for people that are unfamiliar with Imam Khalid's work, which is probably very few of you, I'm going to read a quick blurb and then offer a personal introduction, and then we'll invite our teacher to the stage, inshallah. Imam Khalid Latif is the executive director and chaplain at the Islamic Center of New York University, also known as ICNYU, and affectionately known by the New York community as the IC. He's the youngest chaplain to ever be appointed to the New York City Police Department. He's the co-founder of Honest Chops, the first ever all-natural, organic, halal butcher in New York City. Imam Khalid's powerful oratory skills and his exceptional ability to compassionately cross interfaith and cultural lines is world-renowned, mashallah. On a personal note, I've known Imam Khalid for more years than I can remember. I am honored to call him a colleague, but more importantly, a friend and teacher. We met and really spent time together over a dozen years ago. We did Hajj with one of our teachers, and it was in the blessings of this precincts of Makkah and Medina that I was honored to spend sohbah with Imam Khalid. And Allahu a'lam, the du'as that were made, but I've been in the company of Imam Khalid for the last 7 years to go to Makkah and Medina every March on the ICNYU trip. And we have many people in the audience today that will be on that trip as well. And I think with that, I want to invite him as a friend, as a teacher, and as inshallah, a spiritual wayfarer. Thank you. Assalamu alaikum.
Bismillah, walhamdulillah, wa salatu wa salam ala rasulillah, wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa man wala. You know, last time I came here, my mind is in a lot of different places, especially after the last session with Sister Nakiba. May Allah give you jazash, inshallah, for sharing so much insight with us. The last time I came here to this conference was when our dear brother Osama Cannon was speaking. And he spoke in this room, I think at two sessions. Right? I was here because I was his driver that day, which is great. I'm glad that I've graduated to being able to speak at the conferences. And so firstly, I would just ask, just the reminder of the space has me thinking of him. If you can make dua for him, his healing, that Allah grants him a quick and easy recovery and makes this ailment a means of purification in this world and a means of elevation in the next. My father also had a severe stroke a couple of weeks ago, and alhamdulillah, his recovery has been better than what people had anticipated. It's still a long track, and I think just in hearing some of the remarks thus far and also just in overhearing some of the conversations, I've been thinking a lot about my father, and I'll probably bleed some of that into what it is that I'm going to be talking about today, but I just wanted you to understand some of the frame of where I'm at. So that it's not just coming at you, but we can kind of go through it together. So I didn't go to an Ivy League institution, much to the dismay of my South Asian parents. And it was really interesting when I was in high school, I got into New York University on an early decision. I got in really early. I literally had a physics exam the next day, and I got a 12 on the exam. I was in college, but prior to getting into New York University, and I was trying to decide whether I would apply early or not, I went and had a meeting with my college guidance counselor, who is also the principal of our high school. I went to a small prep school in New Jersey called Wardlaw Hartridge. And the principal was saying that, you could probably get into New York University, you might want to consider some of the Ivy Leagues. And I said, no, I really want to go to NYU. And my father, who was sitting with me in the middle of the conversation, he said to the principal that my son is going to Princeton. And The principal looked at me, and I just shrugged because I wanted to see where this was going, and it was pretty amusing already. And he said, "You know, sir, Princeton's a really good school, and your son likely could have a chance." And my dad said, "No, he's going to Princeton." I didn't go to Princeton, at least not as a student. In 2006, I was blessed to be able to serve the Princeton community as their first Muslim chaplain. I was 24 years old, a little bit more than a decade ago. And it was very intimidating to be a 24-year-old on Princeton University's campus. Because from day one, the people that I met were, here's Cornel West, and here's Toni Morrison, and here's the founder of Amazon.com, and this person's responsible for the resurgence of China's economy. And it made me wonder what I was doing there. And then a week into it, I started getting letters from alumni that said, "We don't want Muslims at Princeton. We don't want your Sharia law at Princeton." One guy sent me a book that was about 400 pages long, and he wrote a note that said, "You don't belong here. Read this. It'll explain to you why." When I sat down with people from the administration to try to understand, simultaneous to my hiring, they had a search for the new dean of religious life, the dean of the chapel. It was an amazing man who went on to be the Archbishop of Southern Ohio. And the way that they explained it to me was, "Oh, those alums thought that we hired you for his role, not the role that you're in. And that's why they were upset." And so, well, that doesn't really make it any better. It actually makes it a lot worse. Why couldn't I be the dean of the chapel here? At the end of the year, Princeton does this thing that's called the P-Rate. I'm not trying to hate on Princeton. I don't know if there's any Princetonians left here. It's a really nice place. Yeah, you all are beautiful people. If you've ever seen the P-Rate, they essentially get the oldest living alumni to march and lead a parade around graduation time, and following them are subsequent years of graduation until you get to the most recent alums. And people come decked out, man. These pinstripe orange and white suits. There's a lot of flair because there's a lot of pride. For decades, it's just elderly white men. And then after some time passes, there might be a sprinkle of color, perhaps some women. But by the end of it, it's still mostly white men. At the end of that year, I was asked to speak at Princeton's Pan-African Baccalaureate. Most universities, whether you're conscious of it or not, have many ceremonies, but some are unofficial. And usually, Black students, along perhaps with Latinos and other non-Black people of color, will have their own commencement. And the young woman who was the valedictorian at that commencement said to her peers that we should always remember what people had to go through in order for us to be here. And just because we are at Princeton does not mean we are of Princeton. But if we do not utilize the opportunities afforded to us to be at an institution like this for the furthering and advancement of our community, then what is it that we're really doing here? Most of this country's higher education system is built upon supremacy. And to understand and assess that in the frame of what I was asked to talk about, beloved community, referencing Martin Luther King Jr. and his notions of what it meant to be part of a society that had transcended bigotry and hatred to the extent that real love and real compassion dictated how it functioned, and principles of justice and true equality were the prisms through which people made their decisions. But a lot of us are in a space where we don't necessarily understand how we can leverage what it is that we have access to in terms of the best of our talents, the fundamental principles and things that are a lot deeper than the fundamentals that are afforded through us to an amazing religion that speaks about the inward and the outward unlike anything else. And can give us a sense of empowerment and confidence that allows for us to move forward in such a way that we can really be the reason people have hope in this world and never the reason that people might dread it. The starting point has to be for you to really assess why you go to the school that you go to. And the era that we find ourselves in is quite anti-intellectual. That you all go literally to some of the best colleges, universities in the world. And you don't want to have a tired, regurgitated reflection here that has you a week from now not still thinking. So when I ask you the question of why you are here and what you're going to do with it, actually answer it for yourself. Because that era that is anti-intellectual, that breeds the racisms that we see, that prevents the development of real beloved community, it socializes and pumps you out to be workers. You're going to be doctors. You're going to be lawyers. You're going to be engineers. A lot of you are going to work in finance because the Ivy institution built off of small numbers of students breeds you to go into high-paying jobs so that you can come back and donate more back to the university and keep the cycle going. There's nothing wrong in learning how to be a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer, an artist, an academic, even an activist. I'm going to say within that pedagogy that tells you to harness the dunya as if it is the only crutch that you can stand on, when they're teaching you to be workers, who's teaching you how to be a thinker? Who's teaching you about why you love what you love or why you hate what you hate, why you desire the things that you desire? And I'm not going to say that you shouldn't learn and study, because we create these absolutes that make no sense whatsoever, and then we throw it at audiences that we have no connection with, and it's irresponsible. Go be a doctor. It's a good thing to do. But the way you studied math and English and science and whatever else to get to these places, if you just compare that to the amount of time that somebody actually sat down with you and said, this is what love is. This is what integrity is. This is what honesty is. This is what patience is. This is what character is. I know that you probably got as much access to it as I did. That nobody ever sat us down and told us that this is how you be, in the sense that rendered that goodness that we're seeking. I went to Bangladesh a few weeks after they opened the border for the Rohingya refugees. May Allah make things easy for the people of Myanmar. And when I came back, I was giving a khutbah a little while later at a masjid in Texas. And I got off the minbar, and in that khutbah, I'd spoken about racism and love and compassion and hadith that are foundational, at least within the Sunni tradition, in which the Prophet ﷺ makes conditional of the completion of our faith the fact that we love one another. You will not enter paradise until you believe is a premise that qualifies numerous hadith in our tradition. You will not enter paradise until you believe, and you will not believe until you love for your brother what you love for yourself. You will not enter paradise until you believe, and you will not believe until you love one another. When I got off that member, and people started to say to me that we didn't know it was that bad in Bangladesh, And they said, but in the khutbah, you talked about it in prisms of race and class. And I said, that's what it is. And then one brother came to me, and he was wearing this long white thobe, had a really big beard, was probably 50-some years, came from an Arab background, and I'm not trying to stereotype him. I want you to get him in your head. And he said to me that you said that we should just love people because they're people. And I said, yeah. He said, I've never heard that before. I said, what do you mean? He said, doesn't the Quran tell us that even if our fathers or our sons have kufr in them, we should hate them? And we went back and forth and talked about mercy and compassion, and doesn't the Quran say that the Prophet was just sent to be a mercy to this world? And he wasn't trying to be argumentative, he was just struggling to try to get it. The next day, I went to a lunch with the people who invited me there, their donors and others, and I started to talk to them about this brother. People shrugged their shoulders and rolled their eyes, and I heard a lot of frustrated sighs out loud, and I said, y'all don't get what I'm saying. And understand the subtlety of arrogance. You don't want to believe that you know better than somebody else. You don't even know the guy that I'm talking about. But I said, this brother looked like somebody who went to Jummah his whole life. And if he was 50, and he even started going to Jummah when he was 20, that means for 3 decades, he went to a Friday prayer for at least half an hour every week, 26 hours a year, for 30 years. How is it possible nobody ever told him to love people, man? But in most of the spaces you learn religion, who's telling you about love? And not like a fluffy love, or a love that gets us scared because we just don't know how to approach it, but a love that is the hub, the muhabba, that the Prophet sallallahu ta'ala alayhi wasallam is referencing in those hadith. A love that is critical, that prophetic voices like King told people to combat darkness with. Hub, muhabba, shares the same root as the word for seed in Arabic, habba. And the relationship between hub, which is love, and habba, which is a seed, is that you could take those seeds of love from your heart, man, and plant them in as many things as you want to. But for it to actually rear something, it necessitates real care and attention, real cultivation. You just throw some seeds in the earth and just expect them to grow on their own, what are they going to give to you? But you watch over it and you look at it and you give it its due right. And the beauty of a seed is that it's not going to ever just give you a seed back, it's going to give you so much more than that. How are you going to love black people if you never spend real time with black people? How are you going to understand what it means that corporations are digging literal pipelines under the lands of true indigenous populations of this country, usurping their lands still centuries later? The only exposure you have to those demographics is in fourth grade when they take you to visit the Lenne Lenape tribes that are not indicative of anything that those communities are actually going through. And to recognize and understand what it is that we get bombarded with, that is the prevention of that real love. It doesn't always come from selfishness and greed, but sometimes it does. It comes from this formulaic process of success that tells you that your goodness is attached to the amount of wealth that you have. Why people have problems with our religion is because our religion tells us that contentment is not tied to how much you own. That goodness in the eyes of God can actually be something that people who are stricken by poverty can attain. That you don't have to have the biggest house or the nicest car to be in the beloved proximity of the divine. And people don't want to believe that. They want to believe that people who are poor are somehow worse off than people who have money. People who don't go to college, somehow they're just not living the best life as people who get to. What is that based on? We go on this Umrah trip every year that Imam Umar just mentioned. We're taking 160 people in a couple of weeks. And there's times, man, where I take my students and we walk around the sanctuary in Medina. And may Allah give us the tawfiq to visit the city of His beloved and His house over and over and over. And you'll see people, man, who are still, unlike any stillness you've ever seen, sleeping on the ground outside the haram in Medina. And I'll ask my students, what do you think? And they'll say that, you know, it's crazy. We're in these five-star hotels overlooking these people, and they're just lying on the ground, and I realize that I have so much more than them, and I'm so much better off than they are. And I said, first of all, what makes you think that that guy's not staying in a six-star hotel? Just because he's sleeping on the ground with peace in his mind? And secondly, why do you think because you are in a hotel and he's on the ground that you enjoy life more than he does? When we talk about supremacy and why it's imperative to know what the obstacles are to our acquisition of real love for others, supremacy is not the KKK in the sense that we might think it is. Supremacy is a mindset. It tells us that there is a norm and the rest of us are always compared to that norm. That nothing of what it is that we are is going to ever be what it is that is the norm in society. That you and I, supremacy says, are always from someplace else. And why we do what we do always has a reason, but there's some people that whatever they do, regardless of what it is, they just do it, and because they do it, that's just what needs to get done. Nobody ever asks why. A friend of mine is on faculty at an Ivy League institution. And she and her husband were having dinner at our apartment, and she was saying how frustrating it is that she shares an office with another faculty member, and when it comes time to pray, she prays in that office, hoping that nobody will walk in. And she says all the time, almost every day, the same people just keep asking me, why do you pray five times a day? Do you really have to do it? Is it that important? She said, one of my colleagues said to me, you know, I'm trying to be Buddhist right now. And so I just go in the bathroom and I meditate in there. Why don't you just go pray in the bathroom? And she said, I'm just so frustrated. And I said to her, do you ever wonder why everyone's always asking you why you do what you do the way that you do it? Do you ever wonder why nobody's asking that white lady who's trying to be Buddhist why she's praying in the bathroom? I took about 20 of my students to have lunch one day at a street cart near our center. None of the students who are with me right now, which is going to be awkward on the way home. We're ordering our food, waiting for things to get done, and this middle-aged Caucasian woman is standing behind us, and she pushes her way through our group saying, excuse me, excuse me, excuse me, can't you understand what it is that I'm saying? I'm trying to order my food. And when she gets to the front of the line, she looks at me face to face and she says, oh, I guess you can't understand what I'm saying. Tell me, how do they say excuse me where you come from? I said, we say, excuse me. And she said, no, no, the place where your family's from, how do they say excuse me there? I said, we're from Jersey and we say excuse me. She couldn't understand how somebody that looks like this is actually from the same place that she's from. You gotta understand something. Many of you are gonna go into a workforce that your hesitancy in telling people that you need a place to pray is not going to be because you don't want to pray or it's not important to you, but you're going to always be basing your decisions off of what somebody else thinks about you. You're going to be scared because it's not acceptable. It's not normative. That's what supremacy is. That when in our historical lineage, our heritage is the reality of slavery, the reality of colonization, the reality of imperialism, and it's intertwined with patriarchy. It's intertwined with overt capitalistic desire that says, go and get yours as much as you can, regardless of what it does to somebody else's living or existence. What supremacy does is that it gets you to think that what you're thinking is your thoughts. But you're not thinking things that you're thinking. You're thinking something that somebody else wants you to think under the guise of you thinking that it's you thinking what you're thinking. Do you get what I'm saying? Why is Deen important in all this? Because our religion tells us to breathe. Prayer is not meant to be a distraction, it's meant to be an outlet from distraction. A recentering 5 times a day that gets you to a place of consciousness that says, where are you really going, man? What are you doing? And it's hard because we live in spaces where we are brought together unlike other parts of this world. And the validation that at times that we seek with an uncertainty of who our God actually is looks to a generation above us and precedent that's set that at times does not allow for us with comfort. And it's not easy, it's hard. But some of our parents are racist. Some of our communities are racist. If you ask me where does it all come from and why it's important to understand, it's because the point of religion, man, isn't that you just sit and you pray and whatever. You do those things, but it has a purpose to it. And good religion to me is about living your faith in such a way that it actually addresses societal ills that are transpiring around you. And if right now your Islam is not calling you to understand the harsh realities of racism and classism that this country is built upon, and how you are privileged to be at an institution such as this and many from which you come. And not just you all who are from Ivy Leagues, I say it to my kids all the time who are at NYU. The egocentricity is pervasive, but we're Muslim, we're supposed to do it differently. And the distractions that Shaitan has piling upon your heads, that at institutions that are qualified at being such a level of education that they're higher, you still have the same tired conversations around gender. You build Muslim student groups that are South Asian dominated, Sunni oriented, ethnocentric in ways that you don't understand how that in and of itself is the distraction. And you just talk about the same stuff over and over and over again. So you gotta break it out a little bit differently. And the basis of it has to be real love. That love that our teacher, Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, talks to us about. It's hard. And I'll tell you it's hard. I find myself a lot the only Muslim in spaces where not only everybody is not Muslim around me, but people hate Islam. And if you can follow my flow of thinking, I want you to understand that for us in this room to recognize what it is that we can be tomorrow, you have to understand what our sister Naqiba was talking about. Because the base of anti-Muslim sentiment in this country is anti-blackness. The reality of our country's founding was an aspiration towards diversity that the European context through which people left from did not aspire towards. And as Europe embraced secularism and liberalism after they had launched crusades in the name of religion, and they launched transatlantic slave trades in the name of religion, our country did not fight its worst battles in the name of any faith or religious system. But our country's worst battles were fought over race, ethnicity. The civil war in this country was about what? The foundational documents of this land gave full privilege to white men. Women were given nothing, and black men and women weren't even considered to be a whole person in comparison to their white counterparts. And it didn't just stop there. Connecticut, where we are right now, in the north, its last Jim Crow law on the books was in 1935. That's not that long ago. I took students to Houston a couple of weeks ago. They had Jim Crow laws being enacted into the 60s, man. The remnants of that nonsense, it's still there. You want to be able to know how to navigate some of this? First and foremost, understand that empathy is not meant to be a tool that dismisses people's realities that are distinct from our own. And I say this to you, man, as somebody who has a lot of connections. I've spoken at things with people like the Pope and the Dalai Lama. I've been interviewed by Katie Couric a bunch of times and Stephen Colbert. I've been on the cover of Newsweek magazine. I've still had the FBI up in my house. When I ask them what they want from me, they say, "You're just too good to be true. Know that we're watching you." Getting on and off of planes is not a fun experience. The realities of being detained, profiled, surveilled, I could tell you in deep detail. I still couldn't tell you what it's like to be a black person living in this country. And you have to understand that, because if we deal only with symptoms, we don't take on actual ailments, then we're not actually really fixing anything. And even if you have to do it in a frame of selfishness, not out of real love, if you say, "I'm fine not having the heart that makes the rest of my body tremble with real anger every time I hear one of my black brothers and sisters get shot in the streets," if you're content and okay with the realities of tons of families being ripped apart because of their immigration status, people who are DACA recipients not knowing what tomorrow is going to bring, if you're content saying that that's not impacting me, understanding that what it is that's happening to them is what is the cause of what's impacting you. And if you are going to Yale and Princeton and Columbia and wherever, and your degree is about you making money, then you don't get what it is that's really going on. My father did not want to be a doctor. My father's brother, who's in his practice, did also not want to be a doctor. They lived pre-partition. They lived under the realities of a colonized country. My grandfather, my father's father, rode a bike every day to a bank where he was a teller and then came back to where they lived post-partition in a town called Gwalmandi in Lahore in Pakistan. And then he would take my father and my uncle, make them sit in the street under a street lamp to read because they didn't have electricity in their house. And while my grandfather wanted my dad and my uncle to be doctors, it's because one of the few things that you could do under that racist, colonized mentality that didn't have you answer to a white person that told you to shave your beard and grow your mustache and part your hair to the side was being a doctor. And some of your parents want you to be doctors for that reason, even if they don't know that that's what it is. The kind of doctor my dad was, I didn't realize until he had his stroke. I knew it a little bit, but not so much. And what really moved and motivated him was kindness and compassion and love. It's crazy, man. Because I go all over the world and people everywhere, of every faith, every background, Sunni, Shia, you name it, they're telling me, we're making dua for your dad. And it makes me think, like, well, what is he made of that these people who don't even know him are praying for him? And the one elder woman, she said to me that, you know, your father, to me, just represents the hadith that says, if God loves somebody, he announces it to all of the heavens. And there's a trickle-down effect of that love. That name gets announced, and people just, they're there with it. I walked into a Walgreens in New Jersey to buy some water for my mother. And the man behind the counter is staring at me. And I'm full of myself. He said to me, you know, I recognize you. And I'm like, oh, you know, maybe he saw me here or there. And he says, are you the son of Dr. Pervez Latif? And I said, yes, my father. And you got to understand, for me growing up, I didn't look like this. I was clean shaven. I had really long Pantene Pro-V hair. I was a real pretty boy, which I'm very far from anything pretty at this point. It was probably the first time in my entire life that somebody told me I looked like my dad. I actually had people when I was growing up say to my face when they met me alongside my father that, you are the doctor's son? And this man at Walgreens, he said to me that your dad has been my doctor for 16 years. And he's been the kindest man that I've ever met in my life. I walked down the street to an Italian barbershop and this guy named Jack asked me, how's your father doing? He said, I don't make so much money. My mom is really sick. He just gives me medicine for her. Literally, a week ago, some random guy walked into our Islamic center at NYU and he said to me, I'm praying for your father. And I said, thank you. And he said, I gave a khutbah at our masjid in New Jersey. And when I got off the minber, all these old people started yelling at me and telling me that I was the worst thing of anything in Islam. And your father alone came and stood up and told all of them to shut their mouths. He said, because your father defended me, I'm making dua for him. As a doctor, my dad does well for himself, but not the way other doctors do. And if you went and looked at the books of his practice that he still runs at 72 years of age, he's got 3 generations of families. And I said to him that, why are you doing this still? And he said that these people, if they didn't come to me, other people would not take care of them. And you look at his books, there's tons of people who haven't paid him for years. I said, that's kindness. That's compassion. That's love. He never throws it out. He never sat down with me and said, look at everything that I did. And this is the way people learned about people in generations prior to ours, pious individuals whose stories were not known in their communities, that they would take their food and leave it for people who were in need. And the only way people found out was after they died. Those people stopped getting food off just randomly. You can't learn that always in a school that's just breeding you to make money. We're feeding into your psyche a pedagogy that teaches you what it wants you to actually learn. And so you will never know Black history by just going to school here, unless perhaps you take an elective in college. And most of you aren't even going to do that. And that's not a knock on anybody. I'm just saying, ask yourself why. If you want a starting point for yourself, I would say read the book The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander. Watch a documentary, it's called 13th. Be in spaces where you recognize and understand that those are just starting points, and go and be with people to learn and understand where it is that they're coming from. And your allyship is not about you imposing your perspectives and thoughts, but you just sit and you listen. And going and being with people in a space like this necessitates, with real love, moving forward to overcome the discomfort that says that, what is it going to be like for me as a brown person to walk into a Black Student Association? It might be strange for you, but what you'll feel in terms of discomfort internally will never match the marginalization and alienation that our Black brothers and sisters have faced for centuries. And when you go to actually understand. Love cannot breed itself when what you are loving is yourself. That most of us, when we listen, our listening is so that we can respond to what is being said. And I'm saying, man, just go and listen so that you can understand, not so you can reply. And where empathy falls into this is that many of us get to a space where when we hear what someone else goes through, we automatically think about something that we have gone through. And then we become dismissive of realities. The same way that people say to us that, well, what you all are going through is what the Catholics went through and the Japanese went through and so and so and such and such. It's like, man, it wasn't right when it happened to them. It's not right that it's happening to us. But you won't actually know it or understand it if the only thing that you're engaging is the stereotypes and preconceived ideas and notions that you have been made privy to in your education and socialization. And it's there. Some of us don't want to admit that we're racist. What does a person look like when you lock the door as they're walking by your car? Then when you're sitting someplace, you hold your bag a little bit closer. What do they have to look like, and what do they not have to look like for you to not do that? The faces that sat across your face at your dinner table growing up, where do they come from? And the fundamental question that we have to ask ourselves is, what would somebody have to look like for us to actually not be there for them? To not stand up for them? To not leverage what it is that we have access to? What supremacy instills within us on a spectrum of whiteness and blackness is an aspiration to be as white as we possibly can. To seek that validation. And to see that it's given to us by metrics of what? Degrees, credentials, titles, but mostly salaries, wealth, I must be good. Look at how much they're paying me to be in the spaces that I'm given access to. That can't be it anymore, man. And what that mindset also teaches us as we are drawing ourselves towards that whiteness is that even if we can never be white, we sure as hell don't ever want to be black. And that disdain just builds itself up innately within us. And so we do delegitimize based off of skin color. That race becomes a symbol of religiosity. That we find ourselves in a place where we're not even recognizing how we are a part of the problem. And then it perpetuates itself. It's hard to have love when you have hate. And you might think that's obvious, but if you don't even know what you hate, or you don't even know what love is, then how are you going to go out and seek it and try to build it for yourself? And when it goes unfiltered and when it goes unchecked, the realities can be devastating. I came from a people, man, that are victim to genocide in our generation right now. 500,000 refugees in undeveloped land in an underdeveloped country in Bangladesh trying to figure out how to live. And I could run you through pictures right now of real people. And since the time I've been there, the number of refugees is almost 1 million. I couldn't meet one refugee who couldn't tell me that they hadn't seen loved ones burned alive in front of their eyes. Not one refugee who couldn't tell me that neighbors, loved ones, family members had been barricaded into homes and the homes were then burned down and the people inside of it also were burned alive. People who said entire villages were lined up and one by one in a row they were shot point blank, and whether they were killed or not as a result of it, acid was then poured onto their bodies. When we were there, I went with Islamic Relief, one person with a camera, and a ton of humanitarian groups were there, and they were trying to film content. Most had not gotten a green light to be there. They were still in the process of being vetted. And they started following us around and filming. And they got word on the first day that said, you can't use the word Rohingya when you talk about these people. Because the Myanmar government did not want it to seem as if there was actual discrimination targeting one group of people. The second day we were there, the UK-based organizations, they were told you can't even use the word refugee. And they said to me, what do you think about all this? I say, look, man, it's not eye-opening or surprising. Where I come from, our government does this to black people. They control narratives. Fear gets constructed. They impose upon us mindsets. And everything the Prophet ﷺ says is true. The dunya becomes the distraction. And it calls you towards it in a way that you're not recognizing what it is that it's actually taking away from you. And they said, well, what does it make you feel like? And I said, I've been in war zones before. I've been in refugee camps, conflict zones before. And I said, what's killing these people is not just the perpetration of hate on the part of those who are bigoted and racist, but what's killing these people is a global epidemic of indifference. That so many of us have the ability to actually intervene and do something, but we still just sit back and watch and do nothing. You have immense opportunity where you're at right now. To have a courage that doesn't just talk to the people who are sitting next to you, but you look three rows ahead of you, behind you, and you go with a real sense of boldness. And you challenge each other and say, what are we going to do to actually make this world better? the skill set, the knowledge, the credentials, with a recognition that our Quran tells us, وَلَقَدْ كَرَمْنَا بَنِي آدَمَ, that all of the children of Adam are given dignity and elevated. No qualifications. You help people because they're people. And then embedded within that is you live a dignified life as an actual human of dignity. That your words and language carry real weight to them. That you never mock or ridicule on any element of gender, race, ethnicity, religious distinction, class whatsoever. But you speak words of truth and hope and real compassion. That your demeanor, your persona is one that with a sense of real pride, you move through this earth that God has given to you as a means of your own growth and sustenance, not distracted by it, but seeing it as a means to a world that is much bigger than this one. You let yourself be what it is that we need as we continue to move forward and we continue to grow. How will you love somebody if you never spend time with them? How will you love somebody if you never hear from them where it is that they're coming from? How will you love who they actually are when they have to be something that they're not in order to be in front of you? How will you build that love if you only stick with people that are just like you? So you start to take those steps. You start to build for yourself the recognition that you and I, we together, we can do it differently. We move forward in a space where we know and remember who our teachers are. And we take what it is with an air of confidence and gratitude towards the divine that he has endowed us with certain skills and capabilities to go and utilize for our benefit as well as the benefit of his creation. We start to build what it is that we have full capacity to build. Because who's going to build the free clinics other than you all as doctors? Who's going to build the legal advocacy groups other than you all as lawyers? Who is going to build the domestic violence shelters? Who is going to build the orphanages? Who is going to build what it is that we have capacity to build? But we're afraid to do it differently. Because the pervasive egocentricity that this supremacist society has imposed upon us needs us to be scared to move in order for it to function. But when we really recognize what these men and women were calling towards and telling us to love one another and seeing that our strength is unmatched when we can put aside these things, and not pretend like they don't exist, man. I know I'm talking a lot, I'm gonna wrap up, but you gotta understand something. It's offensive to say things like Islam is colorblind when you are not the victim of the racism that this country is built upon. To say, can't we just move beyond it? We're all Muslim, we are all people, etc., etc. Likely the person who is saying that is the person who isn't impacted by it. And you start to see and understand how it just gets put upon you. The way this country has influenced many of us to think of our black brothers and sisters synergizes media, politics, and so much. So at a time when the war on drugs was being concocted and crack was being pumped into black neighborhoods all over the country, and politicians were utilizing words like predator and thug, and TV shows like Cops was airing on national television, usually having white men in blue uniforms arresting black men for all of the country to see, reinforcing a passivity as mass incarceration reared its ugliness, disrupting and devastating hundreds of thousands of innocent lives. The war on terror doesn't build itself out any differently. Words like terrorists, jihadists, Islamists, fundamentalists. TV shows like Homeland and 24, Jack Bauer introduced as a character to American public 2 months after September 11th. And you could say they're trying to help people heal. I would say they know it's going to jump their ad revenues. If you stop thinking and you stop reflecting, if you stop being recentered and understanding that your inner self ties itself to your outer engagement, you don't find synergy between the organ of cognition that is your mind and the organ of cognition that is your heart, your days are just going to keep being the same over and over. And there's not anything wrong with that, but then we're not benefiting from all the right that you can bring. We're not able to harness the blessing that is uniquely you, because you're confined into these constraints that no longer we should be confined into. So take some time in your college experience to stand and speak with others. My daughter's here. I don't know if she's still awake or not. Are you awake? Yeah, thanks. My daughter was 4. And her brother was about 1.5. I took them to Standing Rock in the middle of the winter. My wife was there too. And we took about a dozen of our students from NYU. We met some students from Zaytuna, and Sheikh Daoud Yassin was there with them. Linda Sarsour came with us also. And it was snowing like crazy. And the chieftains of the tribes there every morning would gather people around a large fire. And some of the things that they said to the people who came to help them was, know that we appreciate your being here, but when you are here, you have to go by our instruction, not your instruction. Because how you conduct yourself is not going to leave a mark on your reputation. It will leave a mark on our reputation. So they told people to abide by their tradition. And they had people in a space where they relented to the fact that they were taking instruction from the people whose land it was. And people said to me, why did you take your baby boy and your 4-year-old girl to stand in the middle of this blizzard? I said, look, man, firstly, I gotta show my students that it doesn't take a lot to actually go and be with people where they are. And with my baby girl and my son, who I love more than anything, I need for them to understand when we talk about places like Standing Rock later when they're older, that when they were younger, we just didn't talk about it, but we actually went to be with the people where they were. That I could say to them that you stood in that space. And if that land is going to testify what it is that we did upon it, it's surely going to say what we allowed to be done to it. But in their upbringing, I'm not going to keep them in boxes. And to let them understand that, yeah, fine, maybe we're not taking a vacation elsewhere. And we do. I took her to Disney World. But it doesn't have to be either or. It could be both and. And so you start. And you move forward. Do a semester abroad, but visit the parts of the country that the university isn't taking you to. Spend some time in parts of New Haven that people tell you don't walk in those parts. Go to masjids that if the khatib isn't allowed to be black in your masjid, it doesn't mean that there ain't black khatib somewhere, man. But venture out of your bubble. It's going to make your growth exponential. And then that beloved community that we're looking for is a community that we're going to build. That we will have the aspiration towards actually constructing. And then we leave a legacy behind that says that what we found that was good, we made sure that we left it that much better for those that were coming after us. And we took every breath that we were blessed to breathe in this world in a way that reminded us that regardless of what everybody else does, we're Muslim. We're supposed to be doing it differently. If I can ever help any of you in anything you have going on, please don't hesitate in reaching out. If you're ever in New York City and there's something that we can do for you there, let us know. It would be an honor to return the hospitality and graciousness that we were met with here. But if this is the only time that we are meant to be together, then I pray, inshallah ta'ala, Allah Azza wa Jal gathers us all together again in the best of places in the world beyond this one. Please keep me in your dua. You will be in mine. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala give to us and our loved ones only the best in this world and the best in the next. Wallahu ta'ala alam wa billahi tawfiq. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi ta'ala wa barakatuhu.